702.
The Naked Scientist.
Time for The Naked Scientist with Dr. Chris Smith. Happy Monday, Doctor. How are you doing?
Happy Monday. I'm doing good. And I've just been reading a really interesting paper, actually, which is relevant to us all over the world. I went to see a guy at the University of Cambridge, and he has got this paper out this week where they have looked at the climate over the last 2,000 years. You can probably predict where this is going. But they've managed to get the best and most accurate record by looking at tree rings. And you might say, well, how have they gone back thousands of years? There aren't trees around that are thousands of years old. But actually there are, because they're in the roofs of Cambridge colleges. They're also buried in farmland not far from Cambridge, where I am. In fact, farmers in the fens have been complaining that when they're trying to plough this land, they keep hitting these enormous stumps of trees, and they were sort of yanking them all out. And they didn't realise they were yanking out 5,000-year-old yew trees. And so the scientists at the University of Cambridge have teamed up with these farmers, as well as friendly colleges who will let them have a bit of their roof, and modern tree experts, and they're cut very thin sections through the trunks, go under a microscope, and they can count the rings. Now, that doesn't just tell you how old the trees are, with the trees laying down a ring every single year. The thickness of the rings also tells you whether it was a good year or a bad year. And because you can line up this dendrochronology across lots of different trees and lots of different geographies, you can get a really accurate pattern for what year you're talking about, and then you can trace that back thousands of years. And that's what they've done. They published it in one of the Nature journals this week. And you can actually say that last summer in 2023, it was the hottest summer on average for 2,000 years. And that's the most accurate data we have so far, well before any thermometers or anything were invented. Trees already had the answer for us, and the writing's on the wall as far as climate change is concerned, I'm afraid.
That is absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I hope, Doctor, when we meet on a Monday, you also update us on the most interesting and latest findings. For now, we open up the lines. Thibaut, the foodie from Joburg, you've got a question. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Relebukhide, Dr. Smith, and 702, thank you very much. Now, Dr. Smith, if Kim Jong-un is the supreme leader of North Korea, you are the supreme ruler of things. Now, Dr. Smith, please tell me, if you can, please explain how the pyramids in Egypt were built. What is the actual engineering behind the pyramids? Finally, Dr. Smith, and since you happen to know almost everything, what is Relebukhide Mabuja's cell phone number? Thank you.
Right, write this down. Plus 27 if calling internationally. Hang on, I'll better check actually, Lebo, just to see if... did you actually, when you were messaging me, was that your own phone? Are you happy
it's
for me to give...
It's actually funny that...
Are you happy to give me this number? Shall I give this number out? Shall I read this out? No, I'm only kidding.
Dr. Chris and I only have engaged for the first time outside of the show. Was it last week?
A couple of weeks ago, because there was that whole story about using... non-standard antipsychotic medications to try to give people relief from untreatable depression. And we were corresponding about that because I sent you a reference or two. And so now I've got your number. So Thibaut, look, I'll do your deal, right?
Now you have my number.
off air, if you write to me, my friend, and we'll talk, okay? And if Lebo's not nice to me on the show, then we'll sort something out.
You can, if you collect a million rands for my phone number and we split it in half.
Oh, now that's, now we're talking. Now we're talking. You're ever the entrepreneur.
There we go.
Right. Well, onto the pyramids.
I like to make money. Yes, the pyramids.
Onto the pyramids. The actual thrust of the program is people's science questions rather than gaming the system and bartering on Lebo's phone number. An interesting story emerged last week, actually, which is exactly relevant to this story, which is that scientists have used various ways to reconstruct the old course of the River Nile. And it had been a mystery for a long time, how millions of tons of rock were moved to get them to where the pyramids now are. Because by any stretch of the imagination, it's a huge feat and a huge achievement. But it's even harder if you're a long way from any source of transport. And the Nile, where it now is a long way from where they would have wanted it to be if they were going to use the river. Because if you look at the structure of those rocks and the geology, you can work out that they came from a considerable distance away, down the River Nile. or up the River Nile. And so what they've been doing recently is asking, well, where else did the River Nile flow? What other branches and tributaries did it have? And there was a paper out last week tracing a branch of the Nile, which has since completely furred up and been lost. But you can still see it written into the pattern in the ground where it once flowed. And it was much closer to where the pyramids now are. So the theory is that this branch, which closed down and silted up about 300 years after the pyramids finished being built, was probably the route in. So they would have brought those boulders in by boat. They brought them to as close as they could get to the site. And then we believe they probably used some kind of sled or rolling system to manoeuvre these enormous blocks of stone, which were cut at origin and then finessed and finished to make them perfect in situ. But they would have dragged them on sleds and over rollers to get to the pyramids as they were building them. They certainly knew a lot about architecture, and they learned as they went along. There's various failed experiments of pyramids that tell us that their architecture, their ability to take into consideration the constraints and the strengths of the materials they were working with and the structures they were trying to develop, and they adapted them accordingly. But they knew quite a bit about how to manoeuvre these things. They learned a bit about how to do it. They got straight edges. They got straight levels. How did they get levels right? They did things like cut a groove in the stone and fill it with water. They knew that the level of water would always form a flat line, and so you could use the tilt of the water level in order to work out when you had things flat and therefore true. So there were a range of crafty tricks they had, but what they also had at their disposal were thousands and thousands and thousands of people whose job it was to live, eat, sleep and die making those pyramids. And so it was a labour of love. It was a huge human endeavour, made a bit easier by the fact that the Nile was also a lot closer back in the day, which made getting the stone to the site that little bit easier than it otherwise would have been.
Oh, thank you so much for that interesting question. Rueda, I see you standing by to chat to Dr. Chris Smith.
Hello, Dr. Smith.
Hello.
So I'm a proud mom of four kids.
Wow. Hello.
So I'm a proud mom of four kids. I've got two boys and two girls. But number three and four have peanut allergies. So my friend asked me this morning, and I know maybe it's not connected, but weren't you eating peanuts when you were pregnant? I said, yeah, that actually is the truth. I was eating peanuts with all of them. So the allergic reaction, does it only happen once the baby's out? Because if I was eating peanuts while I was pregnant, wouldn't that have affected them somehow?
What a fantastic question. And let me reassure you, you have not in some way through your actions inflicted peanut allergy on any of your children. There was a huge experiment effectively done in Australia a number of decades ago around this subject, because the guidance became, because they were seeing peanut allergy rates rising, that perhaps this is because women, when they're pregnant, are consuming foodstuffs which are then sensitizing the developing baby to that foodstuff. So they said, avoid peanuts during pregnancy. There was then an enormous surge in the number of peanut allergy sensitivity cases in the aftermath. And now women are encouraged to eat peanuts with abandon, as long as they're not allergic to them, of course, during pregnancy. So there's no evidence whatsoever that it will cause sensitization in the baby. There is some evidence that being exposed to things while you are pregnant may, in fact, encourage tolerance in the baby's immune system. So women are not advised to eschew certain foodstuffs, with the exceptions of things that might be a health risk from an infection point of view. Unpasteurized milk, soft cheeses, for example, made from unpasteurized milk because of the risk of listeria, and certain foodstuffs that might be very high in certain substances like vitamin A, liver, for instance, is ill-advised in pregnancy, because vitamin A in high doses can affect the way the nervous system and certain other bits of the body develop. So you're advised to avoid that. So the evidence as it stands is no. What you're eating is not going to encourage some kind of sensitivity in your children. It may do the opposite. It may tolerize your children to certain things in the environment. And as far as we know at the moment, there's a whole raft of reasons why we're seeing rising rates of allergy and sensitivity and things like asthma. But we don't think it's a lack of exposure. We think it's other things going on with the way our microbiome forms in the body, how we're born. If you're born by cesarean section, your risk of having certain intolerances and allergies, and your response to vaccines, as we learned last week as well from a report at Cambridge University working with scientists in China. They found that babies born by cesarean section might not react as well to some of their vaccines as babies born the more normal route. So I hope that reassures you. It's probably some other environmental aspect or some other element, and also an element of chance that leads to this happening. It's not because you did or didn't do without the peanuts.
Thank you so much for that question. Let's go to Rueda in Ondakers Park. Rueda, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And you?
I am good. I am good. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Dr. Smith. I need to know, people who suffer with Alzheimer's, is it hereditary? Is it in the genes? And why do some people suffer for years and some people just a couple of months? What is the eventual cause of this with people with Alzheimer's? Is it some people just stop eating, or is it something to do with the brain cells that has died off?
So let's do this, Rueda, because I feel like we would need a masterclass to answer all of those questions. But let's see, you know, how much we can get from Dr. Chris Smith. And then we will make some time and maybe then just host a masterclass on Alzheimer's, get an expert in. But Doctor, on the things that you can share with the little time that we usually have on this show, what can you share around Alzheimer's and what the science is telling us?
Hi, Rueda. What we know about Alzheimer's is it's characterized by the accumulation in the brain of a substance called beta amyloid and another substance called tau. These two proteins build up, and the more of them there are, the greater the likelihood a person has Alzheimer's disease or that they're going to get Alzheimer's disease, because we think these substances are poisonous to nerve cells, although we don't know exactly why they accumulate. But what we do know is that you can inherit certain genetic tendencies to getting Alzheimer's disease. There is one form of Alzheimer's disease that definitely runs in families, and if people have a particular gene, it can increase your chances of it forming sooner. This is called the apolipoprotein E4 allele, and people who have that are much more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease, possibly because of the way that their cells handle fats, but it may be some other thing. There are also some inherited forms of the presenilin genes also increase a person's chances of getting Alzheimer's disease. So yes, there are some hereditary reasons, and also people who have Down's syndrome and have an extra copy of chromosome 21, the gene for beta amyloid is on chromosome 21, and they also have a higher risk from a younger age of developing Alzheimer change. So yes, that's another example of a hereditary, effectively an inborn form of Alzheimer's. But for the majority of cases, there is no genetic cause. This is probably an effect borne out by the fact we're all living longer. The longer we live, the greater the likelihood we will succumb to some kind of degenerative condition, and Alzheimer's disease already being quite common becomes that bit more common. Bumps on the head, other things that cause inflammation and damage to the brain seem to trigger the injury response, which may be the seed from which the Alzheimer's oak tree grows, but we don't know for sure. But people do live with it for a long period of time in some cases, and it's a slow deterioration where people lose their cognitive faculties, they lose their sense of self, they lose their memory, they lose their ability to look after themselves. And so often people die not from Alzheimer's disease, but because of the consequences of Alzheimer's disease. And so it's often people, they're often in a poor way anyway, and their other faculties may fail them. They may, for instance, become more prone to getting chest infections. They may be more debilitated in other ways and get urine infections and so on. And so all of these things add up to make them chronically less well and more likely to succumb. That's the more usual way that people die.
And I'm just wondering, do you think we're far off from a possible cure? It's just something that's just not possible.
Well, we've seen enormous changes in the last couple of years. We've actually got treatments now. There are antibodies that go in and can target these amyloid build-ups. And drugs like donanemab and lecanemab are two new drugs made by two independent companies that are different but target the same thing and work in a similar way, and they both slowed down the progression of Alzheimer's by 30% or thereabouts in the people who were on the drug versus placebo. So we're not halting the disease, we're not reversing the disease yet, but for the first time in the last couple of years, we've now got treatments that really do, on big trial backgrounds, make a big difference to the rate at which this development progresses. And so, yes, the argument goes we are making enormous strides, and the people who we gave those drugs to already had Alzheimer's disease. So what everyone suspects is if we become better at detecting the disease very early, before it's actually clinically manifest, which we can do now with various blood tests and biomarkers, if we commence treatment with these sorts of drugs earlier, we probably will make a much bigger difference and stop the disease in its tracks, or slow it down to such an extent that a person dies of something else before their Alzheimer's disease they were going to get ever manifests.
Oh, Dr. Chris Smith, thank you so much. Back together next week. And the number is 1 million rands.